Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If. Only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
On this week's episode of White Wine Question Time.
We go into this marquee and there's Naomi Campbell walks in, goddess, and she walks towards me and she says to me, how can I stay in touch with you? And I went, what? And we were like, oh my God, she's there! She's there! Martin Lewis held my phone for me because I couldn't reach. And then Darcy Russell's in half Darcy Russell's turning around going, oh look, she's there! I mean, it was totally surreal. It was one of the most embarrassing moments of my life. I'm fallible. You know, we can all make mistakes. I mean, I remember going to Alina's funeral and it was a circus. And it seemed so sad and surreal. It just didn't seem real. You know, I'm in the middle of the blooming service, they're doing communion and someone comes up and says, oh, would you sign this for me? I went, no, I won't. This is somebody's funeral. This is my friend.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is a woman who's recently celebrated 50 years as a star of the stage and screen. A child star from the age of six, when she won the TV talent show Opportunity Knock, she went on to star in Just William, Bugsy Malone, played Scarlett O'Hara's daughter in Gone with the Wind, as well as starring alongside Angela Lansbury for a year in Gypsy on Broadway. And that was all before she'd started secondary school. Born and raised in Twickenham, her mother Babette ran a dance school where she and her two sisters trained before she went on to study at Art Z and then the Italia Conti Stage School. By the time she left, she was already a huge star and at 16 opened in the original cast for Cats before swapping the West End for TV as two doctor's assistants in the BBC's Doctor Who. In 2015, she joined another BBC institution, this time playing Carmel in EastEnders for 3.5 years, and last year put many a jaw on the floor, mine included, after weeks of leaping around with the agility of a teenager, only to be unmasked as the squirrel on The Masked Dancer. Away from work, she lives in London, where she's about to open in Stephen Sondheim's Old Friends in the West End, and is the mother to Bibi, who's now 22. So let's dial her up, shall we? It's Bonnie Langford. How are you?
I'm really well, thanks, Kate. How are you?
I'm good. That was the hardest intro to ever edit ever because your CV is almost a book. It's a tome.
It goes on a bit, doesn't it? I know. I keep saying, I'm going to write a book. I'm going to write a book. And then I start and I started brain dumping as well because I've always got to about the age of seven and thought, oh, I've done too much now. So I thought, right, I'm going to take different sections. And I thought, right, I'll think about Cats. So I just thought I'd brain dump some stuff that I remember about Cats. And then I've written 8,500 words and I haven't even got to the first night yet. And so then I just get bored with myself. And I think, I don't want to talk about my life anymore. It's just boring.
So you need two things. You need an editor and a trilogy.
I do. I need a very patient editor. I actually need someone to just... I need someone to say, ask me questions. Because also then I go off at tangents. And then I need someone to go, sorry, I don't understand you. Where have you gone now? Yeah. Come back to the story. So, yeah, no, I'm very lucky. I started very young and I'm doing what I wanted to do. And I always used to say, starting young, people used to go, oh, yeah, that you're being made to do it by your family and all that. And I said, you try making a kid do something they don't want to do.
Yeah, and try to get them to put their shoes on.
Exactly. You know, just basic stuff. And you go, you cannot, you know, there might be some that will do things for a while. But to keep doing it this long through the ups and downs of life, as we all know, can be quite challenging. Even the stupidest things can be challenging or uplifting and still actually enjoy what I'm doing. I just feel really blessed. I just feel really blessed I got a head start.
Now, we last saw each other in, what was for me a bit of a dreamy scenario. We were backstage in a very cramped dressing room in the West End where we were both performing for a tribute to Judy Garland on what would have been her 100th birthday. And our dressing room was literally knee deep in legends. In our dressing room, there was yourself, Wayne Sleep, Angela Rippon, Esther Ranson, Celia Imrie and Stephanie Beecham. And then that was replicated sort of five or six times in different dressing rooms with different amazing legendary names of the star as the stage and screen. Do you ever get used to that bond? Because you seemed quite at home in that environment. I just thought, pinch me.
It was a completely mad day and a mad show, wasn't it? I mean, it was absolutely nuts. And the fact that they sort of like opened these dressing rooms and just said, oh, just go in. And the world and his mother was in these rooms. I mean, it was like some kind of bonkers party, wasn't it? Just and he's saying, actually, we have got to do a show here. It was just the most bizarre situation ever. And Wayne sort of dancing and Arlene Phillips kind of saying, oh, do you
Arlene
step
was there
Wayne?
As well.
Arlene was there as well. Who else was there? Rosie Jones was there. Gabby Roslin was there. I mean, it was bonkers, wasn't it? It really was bonkers.
I was there with Tamsin Outhwaite.
Yes.
Also Sadie Frost was there. Frances Raphael.
Yes.
Sylvia Young's daughter. What a night.
Those things are completely nerve-wracking and terrifying. And then on the other hand, amazing, because you get to catch up with friends that you don't actually see. Because sometimes you might be doing this, you might be up for the same job or something. So you don't, one of you gets the job, so you don't see the other person. Or you don't really go to parties anymore. And if you do, everyone's like, oh, hello, darling, how are you doing? What are you doing? This was like, oh my God. What are you doing? How are you doing? What are you going to wear? How are you going to be like? You see people in their authenticity, I think, actually, because we're all as nerve-wracked as each other and then decide to just either get more nervous or laugh a lot. And then you also see how people prepare.
Yes, because there were those that were really prepared. And then there was people like Celia who just...
Oh,
she just
darling.
Kind of cruised through the backstage area and just was Celia Imrie. She
yes,
was amazing.
And just sat there. Sophie Ellis-Bextor was there as well, wasn't she? I see Sophie. She lives down the road from me. We see each other in Tiger, that shop. I love that. I love all that. You know, you just bump into people. But she was at that gala as well. And it's all quite chaotic. But you actually, what people have to do on those things, don't they? They actually have to just sort of turn around and go, well, do you know what? I'm just going to have fun. I'm just going to have a laugh because it's lovely to see old friends again.
So some people were doing, something quite convoluted, like having to remember a reading, for example, so they would go off and rehearse. But for the likes of me, I was just kind of hosting. So, you know, I was able to kind of drink in what was going on, probably with a little bit more of a relaxed ease than maybe your good self who was doing a number. What was nice was watching you all sat there with your phones out, showing each other pictures of children, grandchildren, and you could see the decades of friendship that had built in and out of all of those dressing rooms.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you know, when there is a sort of people go, oh, it's so lovely, you're all so lovely. No, I think actually people are just friends. And if we don't have our real life, then we don't have the crazy life as well. And and that sort of situation is a combination of those two. As you say, we're there doing something crazy. You're all going to do a show. We all know how that feels, to be quite vulnerable and exposed doing something that you perhaps haven't rehearsed much, or that you're just trying to get on there and do for a good cause. And at the same time, you all bond because you're all understanding how you're feeling. And then you have a catch up about, oh, you know, how so-and-so, or what's this? What about, you know, I was probably showing pictures of my dog, as I do all the time, and my daughter, and going, you know, it's actually, apart from anything else, it helps you to deal with the situation, isn't it? Because when you're there with like-minded people, it's very bonding.
It is really bonding. And, you know, and you're amongst old friends, which brings us really nicely to your next big West End project, because in September you're opening Stephen Sondheim's Old Friends with a pretty spectacular cast, I have to say.
It is a very stellar cast so far, and they haven't, and there are more people to come, because there's going to be about 15 in the cast.
Wow.
So it's going to be a big show. So what it is that last year, Cameron McIntosh, put on a celebration of Stephen Sondheim's music. And he had been wanting to do this. I mean, there have been other celebrations. There's been Side by Side by Sondheim, which was a hugely successful show in the 70s with Julia McKenzie, Millicent Martin, David Kernan and Ned Sherrin, and two grand pianos. And they just, basically it was the first time that Sondheim had really been introduced to a sort of wider public. I mean, he was very prolific even then, but this was a review show, and it was very small and very intimate and very successful. We have a 15-piece orchestra and about 16 in the cast, and I think it's all still coming together. They're still putting it together, which is one of Sondheim's songs. And I think it's just really, I think it's a wonderful way to hear a whole range of Sondheim music from all his different musicals. So, you know, we've got A Little Night Music, Company, Into the Woods, Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Gypsy, Pacific Overtures. I mean, literally, and all, it is staged.
It's like now that's what I call musical theatre, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's not just people standing there with a mic and singing. It's a bit more than that. And everyone has a connection with Sondheim of some sort. And so it's a very personal thing. And they've called it Old Friends. And I think it's brilliant that it's that, because it is, it's friends coming together, like you were saying about us doing that gala thing. It is very personal. So it's a very unusual show, because it's not as if you're playing a role. You know, yes, you might adopt a role to sing a particular song, but ultimately it's much more personable and intimate. But we've got this wonderful orchestra as well. So I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be beautiful.
Oh, I can't wait. Well, best of luck with it.
Thank you.
And tickets are on sale now.
Yeah.
Now, so while you've got time to breathe, I wanted to grab you for this podcast because there is so many things that I could ask you. And I'm afraid I've had to hone it down to just three questions for you. And are you ready for your first one, Bond?
Go for it. Go for it, Kate. Go for it.
So, your 50 years in the business, 50 years, has seen you do, I mean, some extraordinary things. And sometimes in the most extraordinary of circumstances, be it performing as a high-kicking squirrel on The Masked Dancer last year, dancing to, I found a brilliant clip of you dancing to the opening number on that Rod and Emu's Wimble show. That was quite mental.
There's somebody at the door. That's what they used to say.
Honestly, your dance moves, you were like, it was like hot gossip had arrived in the building. And then, of course, most recently, we saw you placed quite rightly on the National Treasures bus for the Queen's Jubilee. And I was reading up on it, and there's a brilliant interview with you, Bon, where you said you described the day, and this is your kind of first person account of what it was to be a national treasure on that bus. You say, I was on the same bus as Cliff Richard. He sang all the way, bless him, even though his mic wasn't working half the time. It was like a bizarre school trip. Sharing an open-top bus with Wayne Sleep, Paul Gambaccini and Chris Eubank, who stood at the front of for the entire trip, not talking to a soul, just looking out like he was on a ship.
Yes. He looked like he was the prow of the ship, just standing there with his stick, just poised. He didn't speak to anybody. It was hilarious. Cliff was singing all the way. Because they had these, I mean, why I was on the 1950s bus, I don't know. I'm not that, I wasn't born in
born
the 50s.
The 60s.
I wasn't born. But it was hilarious. And do you know what? It was such a beautiful day, because it was so full of joy. because I think we all knew that there wasn't going to be an awfully long time before we lost the Queen. So it felt even more special. And the fact that, you know, when we drove down that the Mall just towards, well, we drove around the corner from Whitehall, and we drove around the corner at Trafalgar Square, and the mass of people and the joy of just people laughing and shouting and dancing, and it was really moving. It was really moving. And then I turn around and there's Cliff singing Living Doll for the 95th time. I mean, it was, he's so amazing. And I just say the mic wasn't working. And then suddenly Leslie Garrett and Catherine Jenkins start singing You'll Never Walk Alone. And you go, I'm in some kind of bizarre dream here. But it was actually the joy and the laughter and the fun was really lovely. You know, and you had to go. I mean, if you're going to go on that, you had to go, right, whatever happens, I'm going to have a great time here. And
totally. Said you were then herded onto a stage alongside David Jason, Del Boy, mm-hmm. yeah. Gary Lineker and Mo Farah. And you yeah. said, then Ed Sheeran comes out and starts singing. So we all get our phones out to film him. And suddenly this little lady pops out in a green coat and we realise, oh, it's the Queen.
Yeah, literally. I mean, we were like, oh my God, she's there. She's there. Martin Lewis held my phone for me because I couldn't reach. And then Darcy Russell's in half. Half Darcy Russell's turning around, going, "Oh look, she's there!" I mean, it was you wanted to go and hug her, and she was so sweet, now bright green, literally there. I mean, it was totally surreal. And then afterwards, so we went after. They said, "Please don't go away straight away," because you know everyone was just dispersing. There was no way you could get any kind of transport there. You know, but they wanted us all to go to some sort of marquee afterwards so that the crowds would disperse a bit and then we would all kind of go our separate ways. As I was walking towards the marquee, a couple of people coming towards me on their bicycles, I think, oh, that was clever. But it turned out it was Laura Trott and her husband, you know, the Olympic cyclists. And I thought, well, they would be on a bike, wouldn't they? I'm like, oh, that was clever. That was on a bike. Oh, they would be on a bike. That's what they do. And then I went in there and then, of course, everyone's in there. And then Naomi Campbell comes up to me.
Of course she does.
Yes, like you say that every day. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's the sweetest person. Because so years and years ago, many years ago, she was at Italia Conti, where I was at. She's younger than me. But I apparently, well, I do remember it actually, went back there to give out the prizes one year. And I gave her certificate of whatever it was. And she came, so we're at the Queen's Platinum thing, and we go into this marquee, and there's Naomi Campbell walks in, goddess, and she walks towards me and she goes, you gave me my prize when I was at the Italia Conti. I went, oh my goodness, I can't believe you've just said that. And then we have this gorgeous chat and we talk about kids, and the kids, dogs, and, you know, all that stuff. And then she says to me, how can I stay in touch with you? And I went, what? Thank you. I went, oh, well, you know, I mean,
DM me.
Do you want social media? Something like that. And she went, no, let me give you my number. She gave me her number. She gave me her number. And then she said, call me back to check that you've got it. I just, you know, as you know, because having met so many people, the people who have accomplished so much are generally the loveliest people.
Yeah. What a bizarre day. And I wondered, when else have you found yourself in such profoundly bizarre and unexpected circumstances? Because that, as much as that one's got to be in, I would not even say your top 10, it's got to be top 5, surely.
Has. Yeah, yeah, you of know. Course it has.
I mean, we're talking about Sondheim and Gypsy. Gypsy took you to live in America for a year when you were 9 years old. Is that, that's right. I've got that right, haven't I?
Oh, yes,
when you were
absolutely.
Nine on Broadway.
Yes, so I did this.
That's profoundly bizarre for a nine-year-old.
It is profoundly, and life-changing, actually. Life-changing in so many ways, because it was in the 70s. I'd already been in a show in London called Gone with the Wind. And then I went into another show.
With Scarlett O'Hara.
That one. Yeah, I played Bonnie Butler. And so then the following year, as it happens, I auditioned for this production of Gypsy that they were doing. Gypsy had never been to London before. It had only been on Broadway with Ethel Merman in 1956. And Angela Lansbury was to play Mama Rose. And so they auditioned children and I went along and I got the job. And I worked with Arthur Lawrence and Stephen Sondheim. And that's when I met Stephen Sondheim. When I was 8, and Julie Stein, all the original creatives, apart from Jerome Robbins, who had already passed by then. But So I did the show, and at those in that time, young kids were only allowed to perform for 40 performances a year, and it wasn't even, you know, end of December to beginning of January. It was, however, the 12 months was from the date that you wanted to perform. So if you wanted to perform January the 1st, you had to look back to the last January the 1st or June the 1st or whatever, and if you'd done more than 40 performances, you couldn't do it. Anyway, so I was in the show. I was the first baby June. They were going to have to get multiple. They decided to get multiple kids. Nowadays, when kids are in shows, they tend to have about three teams. But on this, they wanted to have one team at a time. And you do your whole, basically 6 weeks, and then you leave. And so I was the first baby June, and I got to perform all the opening stuff with Angela. She was just the most incredible person, and I got to be part of that, and I just adored it. When I left on July the 14th, I never forgot that date because I didn't want to leave. I had to leave the show, and because I'd performed my 40 days, and the producers took my parents into the company office and said, how would you consider coming to Bonnie coming to America with the show? We're taking it there next year on a US tour and then going to Broadway. And my parents were very, very naive and just said, oh, that's lovely. How nice. How lovely. A month later, they just thought they were being nice. What a lovely thing to say. That was really nice. I mean, you know, they were even tricking them. And a month later, the producers phoned my parents and say, have you considered this? And they said, no, because we didn't think you meant it. Anyway, cut a long story short, and lots of ins and outs. I did go to America for a year with my mother. She came with me. She'd never been past Bognor, bless her heart. And there we were going off to America, and we rehearsed in New York, and then we toured to 14 different cities, ending up on Broadway.
That's extraordinary, right? And also the upheaval for you is one thing, but also for your mum, you're one of three children, right? You're the youngest. She has to leave two other children behind for a huge amount of time.
Yes, but the only thing was they were 19 and 17, 18, 19. So they were quite glad because they could then do what they wanted.
Yeah, and also, you're quite horrible at that age. Wasn't that sad anyway.
Well, my sisters were both at the Royal Ballet School at the time. And one of them was about to go into London Festival Ballet and go off on tour with that ballet company. And they were quite glad not to have my mother going, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? She's quite controlling, my mother. And so actually they were like, yes, go! You know, and they were so adorable. And they so wanted me to have this opportunity because it was just completely left of centre. I mean, you know, and we didn't get... We still only had three channels on the TV, for goodness sake. I mean, you didn't have that Americanization that we have here. So it was such...
It must have been otherworldly.
Such a culture shock. Such a culture shock. And I know my mother found it terribly hard. But I think, you know, it's like we do things, don't we? When we for our kids, they make us superpowers because we don't want to we don't want to put our emotions onto them. And also we want to show them that we are invincible, that we can do everything. You know, your kids give you courage. Because you have somebody else to do it for and with. And so, you know, we definitely did it as a team. My mother was very, very neurotic. And I would go, nope, we're fine. We can do this. This is okay. And I was a terribly shy child. But when I went over to America, I mean, when we first went over there. So we were rehearsing and there were seven other kids in the show. And, you know, I remember we went to a cafe and they were all having these amazing things called Coke floats, which was... I mean, disgusting. Coca-Cola with two scoops of ice cream in it. I mean, just gross. I thought they were the most amazing things. I had never seen anything. I don't think I'd ever been beyond, you know, a Fanta, basically. You know, it was like, what the heck is this? So it was life-changing for me in that respect. And then, of course, touring. I mean, one of the places we went to was Los Angeles. And every Hollywood star came to see that show because they came to support Angela. So the amount, and you know, we would go to these parties afterwards, you know, in the foyer or something, drinks afterwards. Angela would have them all the time. And, you know, we were allowed to go and talk to the stars. I mean, a lot of them I didn't know who they were. I've got Olivia de Havilland's autograph somewhere in my storage. I'm going to have to find, I mean, those sort of things I've got to find because, you know, she only died recently. She would have 100 and something, and you know, the Debbie Reynolds, Muhammad Ali, I worked with Count Basie. And most of the time, I didn't really know who any of these people were. But there is this incredible aura. There was this aura about people that you just were. And of course, they all loved Angela so much that the support for her was incredible. I came back and my school wouldn't let the press in and wouldn't let... And they told my friends not to mention it because I would get big-headed.
You've been away all that time and people pretend, like almost ghosted your absence. It was like you'd never been away and it was never referenced.
100%. And of course, we were there because we wanted to train to be in the industry. And they didn't approve at all. And I felt very uncomfortable because we were studying America and everyone, the teacher would say, has anyone been to America? Countless people put their hands up. They were all asked about it. I wasn't. And I got so upset. I actually left the school in the end because I felt I'd done something wrong. And all I wanted to do was share.
Yeah. Share what you did. Well, also you were living the dream, right? You were the proof that there's a need for education around children in the arts because you were out there earning a crust doing it with the best in the business. What about the other profoundly bizarre places you found yourself in or situations that you found yourself in?
Well, one comes to mind. So I suppose it's that how long have you got? I don't know. I mean, ice skating. Something I never...
With Torvald and Dean, who thought you were so good, they hired you, like, on a pro level to tour with
Stop.
Them. That's how good you were, Bonnie
Longford. No, I wasn't. I wasn't in the show. So maybe a year or so before the show went out, I got a call saying that they were thinking of doing this TV show called Stars on Thin Ice. That's what it was called originally. And right. I said, do you want me to be a judge or something? And they were like, yes, that would be great, but we also want you to skate. And I went, well, I can't skate. No skates in my life. Because as a dancer, you didn't put skates on. You weren't allowed to skate. You weren't allowed to horse ride. So they said, oh, great. And they said, would you be the reserve? And so I didn't get any of the training. And this was the very, very, very first show. So this was the very, very first series. It was a real test because... Any ice shows that had happened before, there'd been one huge one. I don't know if you remember it. It was that Nigel did that was like the Gladiators, but on ice. I can't think what it was called. It was Ice Warriors or something.
Ice Warriors, Danny Bear hosted, yeah. Nigel Lithgow produced.
That's it. And it was a huge flop. It just didn't work. And ice skating shows had never been that successful. Anyway, I thought, well, if I'm going to do it... I don't have to stay anywhere. I don't have to go to a jungle. I don't have to be in a house. I don't have to be with her. I can go home. And also I'm only the reserve. So I did a couple of lessons and then they said, we'd like you to try out with Jane and Chris anyway. So I went along. Actually, this is the most bizarre story because at the time I was doing a radio show regularly with Sandy Toksvig, one of my best friends. And I'd arranged as a surprise for her. She's a huge, huge Julie Andrews fan. Julie Andrews was coming over to do a talk at the BFI and I had arranged for us to go that evening. We were doing her show at lunchtime and then we were going to go to the BFI in the evening. And they suddenly phoned me from ITV and said, would you skate with Jane and Chris in the afternoon? And I went, well, I can, but I've got to be away. I've got to be away by 5 o'clock. I've got to be away by 5 o'clock. So Sandy came with me. We went to this ice rink and Sandy is sitting there writing and having hot drinks in the corner and I'm skating with Jane and Chris.
You say Jane and Chris, let's just remind everyone and that's Torvald and Dean, the Olympic gold medal winning Torvald and Dean.
Yes, who are just delightful and sweet and huge fans of Sandy's as well. So they're sort of fawning over Sandy. I'm trying to skate. And all I'm trying to do as well is look at the clock because I know I've got to get Sandy to BFI. I get away. We've managed to get to the BFI and we do meet Julie Andrews. And I have never known Sandy Toksvig to be speechless in my whole life. And she literally went into a gibbering wreck. It was so glorious. It was so glorious. Next day, I get a phone call to say, we think that somebody's broken their wrist. We might have you as a thing. And I went, well, I haven't got time to train. I'm doing pantomime. And then 2 days later, they phoned me and go, you're in the live show. You go live in 2 weeks. And I went, but I hadn't done any training. I mean, I hadn't done anything really. I didn't know any of it. I was just, and ignorance was absolute bliss. I mean, I wasn't completely blissful about it because I was terrified. But I think in a way, I didn't know what I was signing up to. And then on that very first show, they said to me, right, would you come and do your training? This is your routine. So it was about 5 o'clock in the morning. I was in a Slough ice rink with Jane, with Torvald Dean and my skating partner, Matt Evers. And he says, right, we're going to do the skating here and the skating over there. And then you're going to lift one of your legs up and skate backwards, which does my head in anyway. And Matt's going to take one of your legs, your ankles. And then as you spin around, you're going to take the other ankle off. And he's going to then land you. And I went, okay. I didn't know you could say no to Torvald and Dean. And then I did it the first time and it sort of worked. And it was like, oh, okay, let's do it again. We did something. Second time, cracked my head open on the ice. And that's why it's called the Headbanger. Because of me.
Oh, you did. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
Cracked my head open on the ice. And
you still skated on the live show despite cracking your head with your...
Well, it was about a week or so later. It was about a week or so later. And I did one of so they used that as my first sort of VT. And one of the things that happened was Chris came skating over straight away to me and he said, put your head back. This is the biggest ice pack you'll ever get. Because of course it was the ice rink. So I had to put my head on the ice. And I didn't get off the ice. I thought, if I step off this ice, I won't step back on. So I just stayed and I waited. And then I did it again. I didn't bang my head again. I managed to do it. And yes, it then became the challenge that I had to do it for the first show on that first series. I was terrified. But it happened and we did it. And then they made me do all sorts of crazy things. And I was still trying to sort of catch up with the actual skating because I didn't really know how to skate. And even lifting.
But didn't you continue to work with them beyond your time?
Yeah, I did.
Show,
I did about three tours.
They really rated you, didn't they? They really rated you. Let me say that because you're not going to, obviously. But and they've been on this show and you can hear the, just the level of competition and professionalism that sort of pumps through their veins is extraordinary. So you really did capture their attention. Damn. Victims of your own success.
I know.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Okay, question number two. Having talked through some of your greatest achievements, I wondered if we could talk about maybe some of the things that haven't worked out and why they're often just as important. Back in 2016, an assistant professor of psychology at Princeton University published a CV of his failures on Twitter that went viral because it was so inspirational. So if you had to provide a list or resume of your own failures to inspire others, what would you include and what did they teach you? And how will they inspire us?
Oh my goodness. Well, I think your failures go along. See, I hate the word fail. I always go a bit, woo.
So do I. I like lesson.
Yeah.
If you learn from it, it's a lesson. Yeah, then
and
there's
you
a
always
value.
Learn from that. You yeah. always learn. You might, because you yeah. learn to either protect yourself, your loved ones, you learn to view something differently. Okay, here's a failure that we just talked about, Torvald and Dean. I got so intense and so anxious about doing it. I wish I had enjoyed it more. I did enjoy it. I did, but I would get really intense about it all. And in fact, as I said at the beginning, when I did that first show, I was so ignorant, it was blissful. And it was such an opportunity for me to turn around and gave me permission to say, I don't know how to do this. I had never done that before, because as a child, I had always been, don't excuse me for my age. I don't want anyone to be able to turn around and go, well, yeah, but, you know, she's only young. So I was always uber professional, uber prepared, which isn't a bad thing, but sometimes it can make you so busy being professional, so busy being good at your job, that you don't allow yourself to make a mistake. It's okay to make a mistake. And that can be a failure, the fact that you don't get everything out of it because you're so pressuring yourself to be the best you can be. And you can still be the best you can be, but it doesn't matter. If you make a mistake, that can be the best thing for you. So with ice skating, for example, falling over can be the best thing because it makes you get up.
Yeah.
So that's sort of some of it. I would probably put most of my career as a success and a failure, because in the middle of those things, you maybe don't enjoy the moment, you enjoy it when it's happened. And I'm still working on that greatly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Is that because you just become so intensely focused that you're almost too uptight to be able to enjoy it, because you're just willing it to be really good and yeah. then done?
Oh, you know, there's something in completion, yeah. isn't it, that you can look back on things fondly. And then you think, did I get the most out of that, though? Did I just pressure myself and not have the trust and the faith that whatever happens will be all right? It will be okay. I'm fallible. I'm you know, we can all make mistakes. So I would say that sort of thing, those things.
When do you think you allowed yourself to be fallible and to make mistakes? How old were you, and what was the one thing?
Well, I still don't.
Tipped you into a mindset where you allowed that.
But I think the ice skating was I say a liberating, in that I could turn around. You know, they said to me, okay, here, you're on this side of this rink, you're going to skate out into the middle and stop. And I went, I can't do that. And it was okay to say, I can't do that. I don't have to do that. And I was really glad in that first series, actually, I was able to turn around and go, because they kept wanting to say, oh, you know, who are you competing against? And I'd say myself, but they didn't want to hear that. They wanted to hear, yeah, the ice. I'm just actually competing against myself, because I'm the one that says I can't do it. And so that was really liberating. And of course, you do it because you've got, you know, I wanted to say to my daughter, have a go. It doesn't matter if you fail, whatever you do, have a go. And I needed to prove that.
Quite freeing to say, I don't know what to do here, because you've been professional as long as you can remember. I mean, can you remember a time in your life when you weren't
not
a professional
really.
Person?
No, not really. But then I get to do what I love to do. And then when it works, it's great. And even, you know, you get to a point, I think, as well, where you have to be in a situation where you know, you have to sort of say to yourself, whatever goes wrong, I will get myself out of this. I've now experienced enough where I can pretty much get myself out of this. Even if, you know, and ultimately people, you know, the first thing they ask you when you do an interview is, oh, can you tell us some funny stories when things have gone wrong? And you think, well, actually, I'd rather the whole point of the job is to not make it look like things have gone wrong. But people do love it. I mean, now there's a whole show about it, the play that goes wrong. All those things are hugely successful. I think it's that when you do something and the ground swallows you up. I mean, I've done things like that. I remember I had to go to I did a press thing. It was a charity thing for somebody. And they were dear friends of mine, and they'd created this doll. And they made me dress up as the doll. Oh, my God. I think most of the time, I think people didn't actually recognise it was me. Thank God. I hope they didn't recognise it was me. It was one of those, you know, when you just walk in there and you go, okay, here is when I need the ground to swallow me up. This is now when I should not be in this situation. Ground, swallow me up. Go now. I was dressed as a doll.
What were you dressed as?
Sort of like doll. This sort of doll that was being given to a royal baby or something. And it was part of a whole kind of charity campaign. And they said, I thought I was just going to deliver this doll to this royal person. And they said, oh, wouldn't it be great? You know, we're going to dress you up as the doll. And why did I not say no? It was one of the most embarrassing moments of my life. And I just sort of, before I knew it, I was dressed up as this doll. that was probably a fail. A big fail.
A failure to say no. Do you know what, though? You're so right. We do that, don't we? I mean, like, I remember really having to pluck the courage up to start saying no to things because I was so keen to get on and people please that you end up, you mean, like, Google is a horrible thing because it holds it all there. And stuff that I thought I'd erased from my mind forever, my son discovers now. He's like, I Googled you and look at this.
My daughter
does.
Oh, my daughter does. I mean, look. I mean, I did a telly show the other day and they showed an interview of me. I was being interviewed for a film that I'd done about the Wombles. And I was saying it was so lovely because the Wombles are really lovely and they need to be in a story. And I was thinking, oh my God, that's just too awful. So, you know, my home movies are on the telly or on the YouTube or whatever, you know, and there's times when you think, I can't get away with anything. I'm really, really glad that I didn't have social media as a young person because I think that's terribly hard because it's there forever, isn't it? You're never going to be able to grab that back.
But that's very much the case with you. I mean, I could find clips from you from pretty much every year of your life from the age of
probably
what, 8 onwards.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
No. Yeah, easily. I mean, there were clips of you talking about Lena Zavaroni, who was a co-star and a great, great friend of yours. And you were trying to explain her anorexia through the mouth and eyes of a child that knew nothing about it, really, beyond what you'd seen. And it sounds so incorrect now when you listen back and you watch it through the eyes of, you know, generations of people that have grown up understanding that it's, you know, people would say to her things like, Lena, just eat. And you're like, people just want her to eat. And of course, we understand now it's
not
it's
at all. Not and she, you know, she, and also the thing that I get upset about with all that is that it's she's famous for her illness and for her condition, rather than for her huge talent. You know, she had the most extraordinary gift, the most extraordinary talent. And the reason we became friends was because we were at school together and we understood what was expected of us and actually enjoyed that expectation. We enjoyed the fact that we could be mini adults and that we would go in and we didn't have to do any of that networking and, oh, hello, darling, how are you? Because nobody expected that of young kids to be able to do that. So we would sit, we would watch the stuff go on that you see and you take it all in because you're such a sponge. And then they just say, right, would you get up and do your bit now? You get up there, you do the bit, you go home. It's done. It's sorted. We did a television special together, as you say. We filmed that whole thing, rehearsed, record the whole thing in 10 days. An hour-long show, rehearsed, record the whole thing.
And we're talking about the kind of shows, the double-handers that you'd see maybe Cher and Tina Turner do, like with the Cher show. And you were young.
No, we were 12.
You were adults.
We were 12 years old.
Clearly very poorly and very pressured. And a lot of it, you know, I understand it because I was a teenage anorexic. It's about control. But nobody used that sort of language in association with that diagnosis at the time. And I think really, I was very aware of her because I went on to have my own issues with food. But the only people that I knew did were her and Karen Carpenter. And that you're talking about two epic talents who are remembered for the illness under which they demised, as opposed to their extraordinary talent that just
100%
burst 100%. Out of them.
I mean, I remember going to Lena's funeral and it was a circus. It was a circus and it seemed so sad and surreal. It just didn't seem real. You know, I'm in the middle of the blooming service, they're doing communion and someone comes up and says, oh, would you sign this for me? I went, no, I won't. This is somebody's funeral. This is my friend. And they brought her in. She was in a child's coffin, and then as they brought it in, this black butterfly flew off from the top of the coffin, and I said, "There she goes, there she's gone." And I was the last one in the church because everyone had got up. The service was over. Everyone just got up and left, out, and they played her singing, and that's why I was there, to hear her sing. And it just seemed, I couldn't understand why it was like that, and there was a lot of blame and shame going on, and misunderstanding about how the business works and worked. And Lena would say to me, I mean, she phoned me not that long before she died, actually, because she wanted this operation. She died because she had an operation and she wasn't strong enough to recover from it.
And the operation that she elected to have was basically a lobotomy. Uh-huh. It was to change the way her brain... I mean, but like, it just would never, ever happen today. And we are all so much better educated.
Well, at least we've learned a lot from it. At least we've learned a lot from it.
Yeah, you know what? After this, I'm going to go and play Alina Zavaroni's song. And I'm going to dance to it and remember the good that came from all that
and
she
play
did.
Her version of play her than... version of Going Nowhere, the Neil Sedaka song. So she sung that on a television show. I think it's on YouTube. It is the most, I mean, you'll be crying by the end of it, but that the interpretation, the vocal quality, the talent at such a, you know, such a tiny little person came out with this huge voice. It's just mind-blowing.
Yeah. Thank you, Bonnie. Thanks. Okay, your final question. Ooh. Now, I can never, ever imagine you losing your temper. But in 2019, we saw a little flicker of defiance when
what did I do?
You were shouted at in a pret-a-manger. And I don't know if you remember this, but you tweeted.
Yes.
You tweeted, "I've just been shouted at in hashtag pret-a-manger Bromley for taking my dog in while I get a coffee to take away between shows, which is a thing I've done for the past 5 weeks, twice a day, every day. People say be kind, but they're not. Just rude. I'm done."
Yeah. I was so... done. I was so done because I cannot bear people being rude. I just can't bear it. Oh yeah, I am angry. I get angry. Road rage, I'm bad. You know, I will shout at people.
I'd love to see you pulling my obscene hand gestures in the car. But that really juxtaposed itself with what I'd read about you, because before that I read repeatedly that you were a self-confessed people-pleasing, non-confrontational person. So I wondered, when did you learn to start speaking up for yourself, and why, and when else have you had to kind of stand your ground?
Well, I am absolute people-pleaser, try not to be so much. But if somebody, it takes a lot, it takes an awful lot, and my real bad rage is when I go very quiet. That's the worst one. I become terribly...
Your silence is deafening.
I speak very quietly. And I come up with an awful lot of facts, and I will not be. It's just, if somebody is unfair or rude or basically wrong, I will, and not listening to reason, that's it, I'm done. That's it, I'm done. So what happened in that situation was that, I mean, I was tired as well. I was so tired. I was so done anyway. But so I was doing this pantomime in Bromley, and it had been really difficult because of the Omicron part of COVID.
Variant.
And basically, that variant. I was the only person who did every show. We had people going down with the virus all the time. And it was so difficult to keep open. And it was literally like a revolving door of people, just amazing people just coming in, learning a show in a day and going on and doing it, or going on with a script. Or we literally had, at one point, there were 11 out of 15 of us just suddenly went in a day. Everybody had got it. And so it was impossible. But the thing that was keeping me going was not only my little dog, but also I would go in before the first show and the second show, nip into Pret, get a coffee, or Starbucks. They're very dog friendly. Pret or Starbucks, and go and get a coffee and come out. And I went in this one day, as I was always, I was standing in the queue, just waiting to get my coffee. And this guy, who I hadn't seen in there before, one of the staff, shouted at me from the other side of the counter and said, "You can't bring that thing in here." Well, that's two red rags to a bull. First of all, you don't shout at me. You don't shame me in public. You don't shame anybody in public. And that thing is my dog. So it's like a child.
Very dare you.
She is like a child. You do not talk to my dog. If he'd talked to me like it, I'd probably been fine. Red mist comes down. I go, and I laughed. Actually, I laughed because I thought he was being funny. Well, I'd been in there every day. I hadn't seen this person, but I'd been in there every day. I went, oh, that's funny, isn't it? And bearing in mind as well, I've got my hair in pin curls, big hat on, full stage makeup. So it must have been between shows. It was between shows. And I just thought, you're having a laugh, aren't you? I'm here every day. And also, funnily enough, at the beginning of the run, I had looked on the, checked on the door that they allowed, there was no sign saying no dogs, nothing, no, guide dogs only, nothing like that. And I, as I say, they had, no one had ever come up to me and said, you can't bring this dog in here. And Pret's, apparently, it's to do with the managers or whatever. They will allow dog. They are dog friendly, depending on whoever decides it. It's a little bit of a grey area, but they are not anti dogs going in there. And I'm completely. I don't think that anybody should put up with anybody else's. Anyone should be imposed with whatever anybody else wants. It's not. Oh, it's my right. No. Okay, if they don't have dogs in there, absolutely fine. That's fine by me. But the fact I'd been in there every day. And then he shouted at me and then he went, is that on the door? I went, it isn't. I went, show me. So I got this man to tell. So he came to the door. I said, where's the thing? Oh, they must have taken the sign down. I said, there's no sign because there isn't a sign because it's not your policy. Oh, you can speak to the manager if you. And this was so public. And I am not a public. I don't like to be like that. I don't like to be blamed and shamed. I also don't like people to go, don't you know who I think I am? I'm not interested in that. He was just downright rude. He was downright rude and he was wrong. And it just got my goat. And I just came back. And the fact is that everyone's all, oh, be kind, be nice, be lovely. Okay, just be real. We have anger. We are allowed to be anger. Anger can be a positive thing. But that just, whoa, no, thank you very much. And he was wrong. And the manager came, but nobody ever really apologised to me. There was some bloke, except for the fact that while I was standing there, I said, I'm just getting my coffee and I'm going. And while I'd been having this confrontation with this guy, which I hated, one of the staff had made me my coffee and put it on the top. I didn't even have to ask for what I normally have because they knew. I go in there every day. So why did they give me a cappuccino? If they didn't know that's what I had every day, it was just, I was so angry. I can't bear it when people, and I'll do that to other people as well. If I see, you know, I try and be very quiet, but I will always see reason. I will always try and be polite. But if you just tip me that one bit too far, no, I will not have unfairness. I will not have unfairness. If people are wrong, they need to accept it or at least discuss it. It was just the way it was handled as well. It was just so rude. I was steaming, and I just couldn't stand it.
I would love to see you lose your shit. I really would.
Oh yeah.
And I just wondered, has there been a time where you've had to actually kind of throw your shoulders back, chin up, and say something that you felt was, I'd rather not, but I've just got to?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, there's that. It also, you know, Mumzilla. We'll all turn into Mumzilla if we think our child is being treated badly. Yes, that will happen. I will always go for a reason and I will always try and check that I'm right before I start going, you're wrong, I'm right. I will always try and say, you know, let's deal with this. But yeah, of course I have. You can't survive otherwise. You can't be a complete sap. The world's too tough. And there's times when you have to turn around and go, enough, you're wrong. Oh, we went once to Disneyland Paris. This is quite a funny long story. So we went to Disneyland Paris and I'd wanted, it was the first time that BB, my daughter, was going to go to Disney. And I wanted that moment, you know, that just that face where you just, you'll never get it again, where they go and they just see it and the magic's in their eyes still. And I think I was going to be working or something. I said, well, let's just nip there quickly. And so I did the whole kind of, I did a, you know, big expensive sort of ridiculously rash thing, get the US, you know, it was all gorgeous and blah, blah, blah. And we got to this hotel and it was horrible. It was gross. It was terrible. And the whole weekend was awful. And then she was sick and it was just everything that could have gone wrong. The fireworks didn't go off. You know, even down to that, it was just, everything was just all wrong. It just, everything went wrong. It was a disaster. It was a disaster holiday. And so I wrote a letter and said this was awful, and I'm just so disappointed and upset. And they sent me by return a teddy, I think it was a Pooh Bear teddy, and a set of colouring pens and an email for when I go again. Well, that was it. I wrote like a 3-page letter back. Then they told me that there were fireworks.
With your crayons, because you're six, yeah, obviously. Those,
I sent them back. I sent them back. I returned it. I sent them back. And then I found out that the CEO of Disney Europe was someone I'd been in Gypsy with in America when I was 8 years old. I mean, it was madness. It was madness. A small world. Pardon the pun. You know, you might have to see somebody again. You might have to work with them again. You might have to cross them in the street again. I will always give somebody the opportunity to go, that was a moment. How do we move on from this? How do we recover from this? But if somebody has really done something that has got my goat, and then the spark is lit, yeah, don't come near me.
But thank you so much for your time today. I mean, we could probably do 12 episodes and still not run out of things to talk
about. I think so, because it's so great to talk. And, you know, when you say things with like-minded people, and we know we've been there, and we've got kids, and we've got, everyone has a similarity. We all have connections.
Totally.
And I just
There's
love
an episode
that.
Of Motherland in all of us parents,
isn't,
trust me.
Isn't there just, isn't that just brilliant?
And good luck with rehearsals.
Thank you.
Old Friends opens on the 16th at the Gielgud in theatre in the West End of London. It's scheduled for a 16-week run, but who knows, could run for much longer. Such is that songbook, eh? And tickets are available wherever you get your tickets.
Yeah, thanks, Kate. It's been brilliant.
Oh, thank you so much. Pleasure as always. I can't wait to run into you in a sweaty dressing room somewhere with Angela Rippon, Esther Ranson, and Celia Imrie again. Yes. With Wayne Sleep, who wouldn't stop talking. It's like, all right, Wayne, let somebody else speak.
No.
Wayne, stop talking. I'm trying to listen to Celia.
Yes, no, I love him. But once he gets off on one, you can't stop me.
Huge thanks to Bonnie. Don't forget, tickets are available now to go and see her and a glittering cast perform some of Stephen Sondheim's biggest songs from his incredible songbook at the Gielgud Theatre from September 16th. And if Bonnie's left you hungry for more chat with national treasures, we've got episodes with Dame Denise Lewis, Dame Arlene Phillips and Christopher Biggins in our back catalogue, as well as Matt Evers, who skated with her, alongside Torval and Dean, who are also in our back catalogue, as well as Lisa Snowden. So fill your boots. Oh, and look out for our new midweek mini episode drop. It's called Something from the Cellar. It drops every Tuesday, and it's a little something to get you over hump day with some vintage conversations from our previous guests served up in shot-sized portions. To make sure you don't miss them and to get them delivered direct to your feed, hit the follow or subscribe button. And I'll be back Friday with a brand new guest. Until then, thanks so much for your company.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.